Jesus, we thank you again for your word. We pray that it would come this evening to us with enormous power. We pray that you would speak to us in such a remarkable way that our lives are touched and changed. Oh, come amongst us, Holy Spirit, and apply these things to our hearts and to our lives. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. 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 Well, the first point I want to make is simply the fact that truth is attractive. Truth is attractive. You can look carefully at this chapter of Titus and realize that Paul is eager for the Christians in Crete under the care of Titus to live the godliest life they possibly can, so as to be attractive to the watching world of Crete. He kind of hints at that in various phrases. Perhaps the most significant phrase, which is actually there in verse 10, he talks about people living a godly life so that in everything they may adorn the doctrine of God our Savior. If you live a life for Jesus Christ, you do it on display in our world. You don't do it privately. You don't do it in a monastery. The Bible calls us to be a public people, to be on display before a watching world. And so we're called to take upon ourselves all of the features of the Christ-centered life, the gospel-saturated life, and as a result, to shine ever brighter and to beautify the truth ever more extravagantly. So that when people look at the church, whatever they thought of us originally, they begin to find the message of Jesus attractive because they see something authentic and honest and truthful about the people of God. That's not always everybody's experience. And it certainly isn't the experience of people who look at these days at leaders in government, who look at parliament. There's a widespread cynicism and a kind of a coolness and a hostility towards government because of what looks like high levels of corruption and double talk causes people to be unattracted. But when they see real authenticity, even if they don't believe in the God behind the authenticity, when they see truth, it can attract them. It appeals to them. And it may be it causes people to come to Jesus kind of almost kicking and screaming because they originally weren't interested in Jesus. They weren't interested in all that religion. It totally repulsed them. And yet when they see real Jesus really shining through people, they can't deny the appeal. They can't stop being attracted. It's a bit like in the great book Pride and Prejudice, which I'm referring to because this is a sermon for men, and so I need to throw in something for the ladies to make sure that we're all engaged in this. There's the great story, which I totally love, where Elizabeth Bennet spends the first half of the story really disgusted with Darcy. You know the story? She is repulsed by, you know the story, be honest, I know you do. And eventually she gets to the point where she starts to see his qualities shining through. And what looked unattractive to her, she starts to see, no, he is an honest man. He looked arrogant and haughty and full of himself. But now I realize he's an honest man. He's a pure man. He's a good man. She starts to see him for who he is, and she begins to be attracted to him. And for many of us, that's exactly what happened when we became Christians. You lived at a stage in your life where the last thing you ever wanted to be was a Christian. The last thing you ever wanted to be seen doing was going to church. But something happened to your heart where you suddenly saw, for real, the attractive qualities of Jesus. You saw the truth. And maybe you saw him through the people of God. You saw Christians and you saw something different. They may have all been like Ned Flanders, but you still like them. There was something attractive, and it won your heart. Maybe that's your experience. Maybe right now you're here for the first time in church this evening. Maybe you're here tonight for the first time in this church, at least. And you're surprised to find yourself here. You're thinking, why am I in this church of all places? And maybe there are aspects of the meeting which slightly close you off. And you're thinking, it's a bit over the top. It's a bit extravagant. Who are these people? Why are they asking for money? And yet you know that there's something real. It's something truthful. And we're telling you, that's what we found. We pursue God. We find he's not just a little bit attractive. He is the definition of beauty. He's won our hearts completely. And this is the story for many people in Paul's life. And he's saying to Titus, look, let godliness be on display. Because that way the people around you, even if they don't like you, they'll have to acknowledge the fact that there's something different. And you'll adorn the message of Jesus. And now he's going to apply it specifically to different groups. And as I said, this week we're looking at the men particularly. And next time we'll look at the women. But he starts here with the older men. Older men, verse 2, are to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled. There's three very sort of classical virtues. Sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled. Everyone would agree those are good things for an older man to display. If you're wondering, by the way, what an older man is, Hippocrates, the Greek physician of ancient times, said that anybody below 56 is elderly. Anybody above 56 is just old. That's what Hippocrates said. Now, Hippocrates didn't write the Bible, and he was a pagan, and he was wrong, so we'll ignore him. But nevertheless, just to give you some idea, in Paul's day, the kind of people he's speaking to, that's the kind of age range. Now, people live longer these days, so don't get too depressed. The difference is, there's older people, there's younger people. Usually, you can more or less know which one you are. Spurgeon said, if you're young, grow up. If you're old, stay young. That's a helpful motto to live by. But older men are to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, sound in faith, in love, and in steadfastness. Now listen, the first three virtues there were kind of Greek classical virtues, but he starts talking now in a very different way. Those things, faith, love, and steadfastness, they might remind you of something else Paul talked about. Maybe you've remembered that Paul talked in one place in 1 Corinthians about three things, great things remaining: faith, love, and hope. Faith, love, and hope. Faith towards God, love towards others, hope towards the future, really. Faith, love, and hope. Now, here, he doesn't use quite the same triad, because although he goes with faith and love, he doesn't go with hope. He goes with steadfastness. Now, why does he talk about steadfastness specifically to the older men? Hope, but when it applies to the older men, it's steadfastness. Well, look, this is why. Steadfastness is just hope with a few more years. It's hope 30 years later. It means pressing on in hope, holding on to hope, even if you have to hold on tight sometimes. Steadfastness. You see, there are certain temptations that come more hard to older guys than they do to younger guys. Maybe younger men find it easier to hope. Maybe hope springs a little bit more freely from younger men because there's an idealism about some young men. They like to have dreams and visions. They like to imagine a great future, and they set their path in great, very heroic terms. Older men, perhaps there's a temptation to throw hope aside because life's just been long. And maybe life's had its disappointments and its frustrations. And Paul says, steadfastness. Hope applied at old age. Steadfastness. One of my favorite writers is a man called D.A. Carson. And I was listening recently to an interview where he was talking a little bit about his father. His father was a pastor in Canada before the war, and not a particularly heroic or glamorous man, but in many ways an extraordinary man. In terms of his godliness, in terms of his faithfulness to the gospel, a great man, actually, truly great. And Carson was talking about the way his father used to pray. And the prayers he prayed would be in his journal, which he wrote down. And Carson quoted some of them. This is a transcription of what he said in the interview. In his journals, he recorded words to this effect: save me from the sins of old men. A tendency to look backward and idealize the past. The temptation to resent younger men coming along who are more successful than I was. Too quick to turn on the television because I'm lonely. Insufficient intercessory prayer for my grandchildren. He just went down the list, this long thing, and said, "Save me from the sins of old men." See, there's certain kinds of temptation that an older man is going to face that the younger man doesn't really know about necessarily. The disappointments and maybe comparing the present with the past disfavorably, imagining the past in some glowing version, which didn't really happen, but our nostalgic minds like to present it. And we long for the past. We feel frustrated, disappointed. We don't like how things have turned out. And Paul is saying steadfastness. Hold on to hope. Hope in what? Hope in everything going exactly as you expected? No. Hope in God. Hope in the God who does keep his word. Hope in the God who is watching you in this stage of your life, caring for you in the years of gray hair, in the years of advancement. He's looking over you just as intently as he was when you were 20 and full of ideas. Hope, steadfastness, hold on to him. So these things need to be spoken to those in the older generation. I suppose for many older guys, there's a tendency to perhaps disqualify ourselves because we see younger men emerging in the church, in our work, in all kinds of contexts. And we start to feel, well, I don't have a part to play. And that can make us feel disgruntled, or it can just make us abdicate. And actually, the best way to handle that is to see yourself differently, to start thinking, well, look, I am going to now be a coach and not a player. Maybe I have a different role now. Maybe there are others who are on the pitch, but I have a part to play which is utterly essential in bringing words of wisdom, words of truth, words even of rebuke, words of correction that actually turn the course of their lives, because all young men will make stupid mistakes without the wisdom of senior coaches who can come alongside and speak words of wisdom and guard them and get them out of ditches and protect them from hazards that they walk into without even thinking. Because young men do that, don't you? So this church needs all of the older guys it can get, desperately, desperately. And you young men, you need to listen to them. You need to seek them out as well. Some of you don't go near older men, and I suppose maybe it's because you expect that they won't want to talk to you, that they won't want to serve you, they won't want to listen to you, and you're wrong. You're just wrong. There are older men in this church who are longing to be able to interface with guys that are coming through, perhaps into leadership, perhaps new Christians, and just serve them by bringing wisdom to them. Great wisdom to them. And really, you're a fool if you avoid that, if you ignore that. Seek it out. Seek out wisdom. It's beyond rubies in its value. Look for it in older guys, the good older guys, you know, the guys that know God, the guys that have got a good track record, who've done well in the things that you've got to do now. In getting married and working hard and raising kids to know Jesus, those things. If you know guys in the church who've done that well, brothers, seek them out. Don't complain about, well, I don't know any of them, and we don't intermix in this church very well. That's not just a structural problem. That might be because you haven't taken initiative, because you haven't actually tried to intermix. You haven't taken a bold step of saying, that man looks like he's over 40. I shall talk to him. It's not that difficult, really. Really, it isn't. And you don't have to have a special meeting set up. So you can sit across the table, and kind of just have some kind of special negotiation. No, just interact and seek out wisdom. And give off the impression intentionally that you're glad for the wisdom. See, I know you young guys, you don't intend, I'm sure you don't intend to come across as brash and arrogant. You don't intend for the older guys to think that you can learn nothing from them and their foolish ways because they were born before the 60s. You don't intend to give that impression, but you probably do without trying. You do. You give that impression without meaning to. And a lot of older guys probably would love to serve you, would love to get closer to you, but they imagine that you are utterly impervious. And you need to press in and look for that kind of connection, those kinds of relationships. So older men, steadfastness, and look for the key role that you can play in the lives of other young guys. But then he starts to speak to younger men. This is the next point we're looking at. Verse 6, likewise, urge the younger men to be self-controlled. Self-controlled. It's interesting. He doesn't say, urge the younger men to be safe. Urge the younger men to be risk-free. Urge the younger men to never, ever try anything new. To be nice church boys. That's what we need, Titus. No, he doesn't say, he says self-control. There is a difference here. You see, the Bible never calls men to be simply nice, safe guys. It doesn't call us to that, really. The church often does. The church often gives the impression that really what we want from guys is just compliance and safeness. And actually just almost an effeminizedness, almost neutering the guys. Taking away any sense of manhood and masculinity, taking away any courage, any initiative. And that's the impression that the church often has given. There was a president about 100 years ago in America, Teddy Roosevelt, and he was working voluntarily in a Sunday school for children. And one Sunday, a boy turns up, little boy, with a black eye. Roosevelt said to him, why have you got a black eye? And the boy said, well, on the way to the meeting, my sister got bullied by another boy. So I hit him. And we got into a scrap, and now I have a black eye. Now, what would you do if you were serving in the children's work and a boy came along with that story? Well, Roosevelt gave him a dollar. Well done, son. You fought for justice. Well done. You stuck up for the weak. You stuck up for the oppressed, your sister. You dealt with the bully. Roosevelt got sacked that week. He was asked to leave. He was taken off the rota. We will not have that kind of man serving with our children's work. And we will not have that kind of boy in our children's work. And the church says that all the time. If you're a man with any sense of aggression, any sense of rage against injustice, any sense of passion to get something done, to be courageous, to step out and do new things, to be an initiative taker, to press through with the courage of your convictions, you are not welcome here. We don't want that kind of man. We want nice, compliant men who are predictable and easy and do nothing and change nothing. That will help us. But Jesus was never like that. And the men Jesus called to himself were not like that. They were dangerous. They were crazy. He had to hold them back. The fact he had to hold them back is revealing. He chose guys he had to hold back. He didn't choose guys he had to keep kicking out. He had to hold them back when they said, we'd like to blow this village up, please, master. Because they didn't agree with the message. He said, no, guys, yeah, I like the zeal, but wrongly applied. That's the kind of guy you need. Sons of thunder who are looking for opportunities to smite the evil one. And that's actually what is in the heart of so many men who feel displaced, they feel uncomfortable around Christian folk. Because they're not allowed to be blokes. You're just not allowed to be a man here. So that's for you. That Christian thing's for you. It's totally uncomfortable to them. But truth, honest be told, that in the heart of guys, there is something God's put there. A desire to serve God faithfully and to heroically do something great for God. To leave a legacy behind. To imprint something on the world. There's something specific. Guys, my son is, one of my second son is just 2 years old. He was drawing things with some other children. I can't remember the context. It was very recently. And they were asking the children what they were drawing. He's only two, so he wasn't very good. So they had to ask him, what are you drawing? And he says, he's just drawing away. What are you drawing? A gun. He's 2 years old. So my wife told me when I got home, and Honestly, it was one of the most moving moments of my life. I just just welled up with emotion. Just
a gun, yes.
Now listen very carefully. Some of you, right now, I know what many of you guys are thinking. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, he's talking to all the alpha males. He's talking, he wants us all to come to church with guns. It's just, he wants us to be aggressive. He's one of those preachers that's just looking for guys to, you know, be hard. And that's just not me. I'm not that kind of guy. I can't be that. I'm not that, I'm different. I'm more sensitive. I'm just, all right, I hear you, but it's just not me. Listen carefully. Listen, you need to understand. Listen, look at me. I wear glasses, okay? Only minutes ago, I was quoting Jane Austen to you, okay? I read poems and enjoy them. Okay, I'm not trying to say, let's all go wrestling. You don't have to fear. Don't be frightened that there's some kind of false macho culture that I'm trying to produce here in one sermon. It wouldn't work anyway. I'm calling you two men is to take responsibility. That's it. To be men and take responsibility. To say, the buck stops with me. I'm called. I'm called by God to lead. I'm called by God to stand up in that authority of Adam, to subdue the earth, to bring it under the lordship of the Almighty God. And that's a responsibility that I'm not to fiddle around with and play around with. I need to feel the weight of that and learn to be self-controlled. So you might be saying, are you saying it's all right then that I'm more sensitive, that I listen to certain kinds of music? Yes. You know, I like reading poems. Yes. I like looking at great paintings. Yes. I like listening to James Blunt. No. Okay, you crossed the line there. That's the no. Okay, everything else before is fine. But there are all kinds of expressions of this, gentlemen. But I'm pleading with you to see your masculinity as something God gave you. To see that your desire for adventure as a God-given thing, not something to apologize for. And feel embarrassed about it and think, oh gosh, am I going to get away with this? What are they going to think of me? What are the elders going to think of me? But your willingness to be zealous, passionate, to make your mark, to take a lead, to take initiative, it is God-given. And it's your responsibility to see it fulfilled and expressed and to bring it under self-control. Self-control. See, you could miss him. You could think, well, this is just brashness. I'm saying self-control. See, there's a lot of guys who have got plenty of zeal and they're looking for a fight, looking for some action, but they have zero self-control. They don't even see that as a virtue. Self-control, what's that got to do with it? I'm a man. The world has to put up with my mistakes. I'll make a mess wherever I go. I don't need self-control. That's for others. They can do the shock, you know, the damage control after I've been there. No, self-control. Winning battles over the self. One of the heroes of history is another quote I'm going to read to you from John Milton about Oliver Cromwell, who was an interesting man, 17th century. This is what Cromwell was like, though. Milton says this about him, about the way he began as a general. He first acquired the government of himself, and over himself acquired the most signal victories, so that on the first day he took the field against the external enemy, hewn as a veteran in arms, consummately practiced in the toils and exigencies of war. By the time Cromwell got to his first taste of battle, he had already won the great battle over himself. So he was a seasoned fighter. He was a veteran. He'd won the biggest battle of all. So the other battles were kind of easy because he'd learned to control himself. Some of you gentlemen, there are battles you're called to. There are battles for this city. There are battles that must rage and will rage if by God's mercy we get to fight them. But you're not ready for them because you're still fighting the battle over yourself. And you're aware of it. You're aware that you're kind of out of control. And you kind of tolerate that. You just accept it. You think, well, I'm just a mess. That's who I am, really. The fact that your emotions fluctuate to a horrible degree, that there's these seasons of euphoria followed by seasons of deep depression. Times when everyone has to put up with how miserable you feel, and times when everyone has to put up with how high as a kite you are. Because you don't have this self-control. There are guys who, however much we talk about it, however much we preach about it, you're just feeling that you keep going back to certain websites just again and again and again, and you're just fighting this battle, but not really fighting, not really expecting to win, so what's the point of even troubling yourself? Because I'm just a loser, and I'm just the devil's plaything, and, you know, if I have a good week, he puts an end to that. And, you know, that's what I am. I've got this problem with masturbation. That's my difficulty. I'll just keep going with it. I'll just live with that. Just allow myself to become just chicken feed for the enemy. There's no self-control. But, friends, if Paul is saying this, there must be a possibility for it. And the fact he tells Titus, urge them to be self-controlled. It means there's a fight, right? There's a battle. And friends, you're called to win it. And by the grace of God, because of the gospel, you will win it. By God's mercy, you're going to win it. If you just assume and accept that you're just, well, that's it, that's my story, that's the story of my life. Instead of knowing the story of your life is Christ in you, the hope of glory. Well, friends, that's, you're not doing what Cromwell did. You're not fighting to win in yourself. And my prayer, my plea for many of you this evening is that you're going to leave things behind you, in your chair even. Just leave this room eventually, at the end of the evening, confident. Things have been left behind. You understand, again, your identity as a man of God, someone with authority, someone with a calling, a high calling, to have victory, to win, to fight through these things by the gospel of Jesus Christ, to fight and have success on this battlefield so that we can fight other ones. There's going to be huge battles. There are things that we're going to have to effect for the glory of God in this city. It's going to take great strength, great courage, great perseverance, great steadfastness. And so that's why the stakes are high on the battles you're fighting in your own self. That's why it's important that you win there so you know you can win here. Do you see? You need to press through this. You need to be confident. No, I've got the enemy. I know how to win. I can fight here. By the grace of God, I can come through. Not because I'm some hero, but because of the mercy of Jesus Christ. And it means men taking responsibility. It means us looking to see men develop. It means us looking to help guys to be strong. See, I'm going to be speaking to the women in a few weeks, and I know that relatively often people will say to me, do we have more women's events planned and so on? When are we going to do more women's things? Trust me, we want to do that. We do do that. We do women's events. We'd like to do more. We want to keep putting together programs to do that kind of stuff. But the truth be known, the best thing for the women of this church, I honestly believe this, I know this, the best thing ultimately is for the men to be biblical men. That's what we need. That's what we need. We need great men to come through, great, great men to come through. And we'll keep looking for ways to serve the women with programs and stuff, but really the programs will make no difference if the men are not being real men. The men are not standing up in their calling as men of God. And we'll keep doing these things. We'll keep looking for ways to serve guys. We'll keep gathering them. We'll do that again in the autumn. We'll do it next May. We'll gather for a weekend with guys. In fact, one of the things we want to do next May is gather for a weekend where we actually invite guys to bring their sons if they're in their teenage years. So if they're sort of 12 and over, they can bring their sons, because we want sons to grow up looking around for a weekend with guys that they want to be like, who love Jesus and are different. And so when they hit that stage in life where their hormones go crazy and they just think, oh, I'm either going to go down into the ditch of depression and listen to a lot of emo music, or I'm going to just go, you know, opposite direction and just become out of control. No, I'm going to see stable, self-controlled men around me who are wise, godly, who know how to lead, who know how to take control. I'm going to gather with them. I tell you, we're going to find ways to do this. We want to keep raising guys up. And the truth is, we have to emphasize this. Some of you don't like the fact to emphasize. Some of you are annoyed with me right now because I keep going on about it. But I have to go on about it because the truth is the church hasn't gone on about it. This is why we have churches that are women's clubs with a few male officers, as Leon Podolsky puts it. And because there is a strange absence. I mean, we put together the Impact Training Year where guys come on voluntarily, where men and women are called to come in. We look for people to give up a year to serve in the life of the church. I tell you, it is a delight. It is a joy to see what happens in their lives. It is a great privilege. In fact, the Impactors students we've got now should be here tonight. Could you stand up wherever you are? Or you could just stand. Can we just applaud these guys? This year, they've done an incredible job. They've carried responsibility, they've worked really hard as a team, they've got to know us as staff, and they've served wholeheartedly, and they have grown enormously. They are great pioneers, mighty men and women of God. And we do this every year. This next year, we're doing Impact again. Do you know what? We have loads of women booked in for it. We have one man. It's not good enough. Some of you men in this room, you should be doing Impact next year. That's what you should be doing. That is what you should be doing. What's God's will for my life? Do Impact next year. He just told you. Easy. What could be better? 12 months of being right in the heart of God's mission for this city. Serving, getting trained, getting developed, working with leaders, learning God's ways in a tight context where you're going to get tested, you're going to hit difficulty. You're going to come out of it strong. I tell you, some of you men, that's exactly what you need. That is exactly what you need. I want to see that booked in. You should go straight downstairs after this meeting and say, I want to do Impact next year. Give me the whatever, details, website, whatever. I want to do it. Because it will do you good. We want to raise up great, mighty leaders, men and women of God. And at the moment, we're looking to see guys coming on Impact. That's just one application of this. But you know my heart. You hear what I'm saying. Guys, this is what Titus is being told by Paul. Timothy gets told the same thing. I want men everywhere to lift up holy hands to God without quarreling. And to pray, not to fight, not to be constantly squabbling, looking for their own slice of the action, but self-control, humble, and yet nevertheless living out an adventure for God, serving in the heart of God's mission, and being aggressive for the King of Kings. So let's look finally at how this is possible. Because this is the question, surely. See, Paul never, ever tells us to do stuff without telling us why. It's just not his style. He's not like that. He's not just the kind of guy who gives you rules. You know this book. I've told you, we tell you all the time. It's full of truth of what has happened, what has been done, and then it tells you how we live. It's just that Titus, as a book, does it the other way around. So normally, in the books that Paul writes, he starts off by spending chapter after chapter telling you about what Jesus has done for you. And then he says, now, since Jesus has done this for you, this is the way to live. In Titus, he starts off by saying, Titus, this is how to live. This is how they should live. And then he comes back in verse 11 with the word because, or the word for. Very simple word, but carries an enormous amount of freight. For the grace of God has appeared. That is why, and that is how. See, I could just stand here and exhort you till I'm blue in the mouth. I could stand here and say, men, be real men, and just go on about it for ages. And some of you might even feel very motivated and go home thinking that you've been changed. Truth is, you will have not been changed. Just your emotions would have had a flutter for a few moments, but no real power would have come into your life necessarily. And it's possible for guys to obey in a certain way, to comply, to be in to behave nicely, but not take an ounce of initiative. And it's even possible for some guys to say, no, all right, I will take initiative. I will start to take a lead, but not actually do it knowing what the reasons are. It's possible for people to behave well without the gospel. But Paul is saying, no, we want the gospel to be at the heart of our behavior, at the heart of everything. You see, I remember when I was a boy, I lived with, I had three brothers. There were four of us, and every Christmas we would watch the Queen's speech. It was a kind of tradition we just, for some reason, had. And my grandfather would join us most Christmases. And he had fought in the war in Burma. He'd been a major. He was a fairly seasoned soldier, and he'd seen some very horrible things for his country. So when God Save the Queen would start to play at the end of the Queen's speech, in front of everyone in the lounge, he would stand to attention. And we would sort of, you know, kind of get a bit awkward and, well, what do you say? And then we'd start to copy him. We'd all stand up as well and try not to giggle. So right there you had five males standing up for God Save the Queen. Four of them had no idea why they were doing it. One of them could have told you story after story. One of them had a story. The other four were just messing around. See, we don't, I'm saying, guys, the Bible doesn't teach men just to try and behave. Otherwise, you're just messing around. You're just standing up for a joke. You need the story. You need to know the story. You need to have this truth blazing in your heart. This is what makes men different. For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, training us to renounce ungodliness. Training us. See, the grace of God comes to you as a saving thing, but as a training thing as well. Grace teaches you. It may say in your translation, grace teaches us to say no to ungodliness. It trains you, it teaches you, it helps you. Grace comes alongside you and helps you to bring about change. Without the gospel, without grace, without God's kindness and generosity of help in our lives, all of my attempts to motivate you will simply be like ignition in a car with no fuel. You see, you can make a lot of noise in a car with no petrol. You turn the ignition and just kind of, you know, you have the lights flashing. And put the radio on, and even sound the horn a few times, just to good measure, and get the wipers going. It's great, there's stuff going on, but zero progress, no progress. And a lot of Christian guys, there's a lot of noise, but there's no progress. And the answer is not just turn the key harder. Just turn the key a bit harder, because all you get then is just... Isn't that what you get? I tell you, guys, a lot of Christian guys, it's just desperate efforts. Just try a bit harder, try a bit harder. Just try a bit harder. Oh, it doesn't work. He said that, you know, you could give up these sins, but it doesn't work for me. Works for the elders. They're real Christians. Doesn't work for me. I said I'd stop doing that, and I went straight back and did it. It doesn't work for me. What can you do? Just forget it. Forget it. I just keep turning the key and nothing happens, so just leave it. But the grace of God has appeared. It trains us to say no to ungodliness. How does it do that? Well, look at some phrases here, and it gives a few clues. Training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions. Passion's a strong thing. How do you just stop a passion? Passion controls you, right? If you have a passion for something, it's not something you lightly toss aside. It's got you. It's gripped you. I have a passion. I cannot give this up. It's just a passion. I'm never going to be free. Well, no, that's not true. The grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions. The grace of God goes around the gym with you, training you. Teaching you to win. Teaching you to win. And the way that passions get dealt with, do you know what? You don't deal with passions just by just trying to reduce them, quell them, fight against them. If only I was less passionate. See, God's problem with us is not that we're too passionate. The problem with us is that we're not passionate enough, right? This is exactly what it goes on to say. Verse 14, Jesus gave himself for us to redeem us from all lawlessness and to purify for himself a people for his own possession who are, get this, zealous for good works. Same idea. Zeal, passion. Jesus died upon the cross, rose from the dead to put passion inside you, to put zeal, to put a fire inside you of such desire for God, such a desire for righteousness, for goodness, for self-control, a desire for it. Not just a compliance to it. Not, oh, well, the preacher said, I've got to give it up. I suppose I ought to. Christians don't really do those things. No, a desire, a passion, a zeal for godliness. That's the answer. That's what you need. You need fuel in the tank. When you have that, you turn the key and off you go. That's what happens. You take those steps. You take those steps of obedience. You take those steps of renunciation. It says here, renouncing ungodliness. But you don't do it with an empty tank. You do it with the grace of God empowering you to overcome. An energy that you didn't expect to be there is there. You find, I'm not a slave anymore. I used to think I was a slave. What was I thinking? Jesus died to set me free from slavery. He was bound up. He was nailed to the cross so I could be set free. Liberated, enjoying incredible liberty. Even over these hang-ups and things that control me and make me so lose my dignity. Liberty. It's what you're called to. The Bible says in Romans chapter 6, sin shall not be your master. Sin shall not. It doesn't say sin must not. It says sin shall not be your master. If you're born again, if you really do know Jesus here tonight, if you're a Christian, that's your story. You're set free from slavery. So live in the freedom that he's bought for you. And start to see yourself differently. And then start to think through the implications of that. And when you're renouncing, when you're making your willpower decisions of turning your back on sin and saying no to ungodliness, when you're renouncing sin and worldly passions, trust that the grace of God is there to give you success. You have to renounce, though. You do have to. You can't just say, well, look, it will just all fall into my lap. Godliness will just happen to me. God's going to do it in me. And so I will just sit around. I'll lie around in bed. I won't set the alarm. I'll just live my life in a dreary, mediocre Christian way. And one of these days, God is going to come and set me free and turn me into the Pope. And it will be instant. I'm looking forward to that day so much. The Bible doesn't talk about that day. Talks about the day that happened. Happened. You were set free. Now, renounce. Renounce it. That means wholeheartedly. Renounce is a strong word, again, right? In the NIV, it says, say no. See, what you can tell that God's working in a man's heart if he's learned to say no a lot. He's learning now to say no. He's learning to fight battles and say no to things he used to say, well, maybe, tolerate. All right, oh, you have it your way. Okay. We'll have another drink. All right. Well, I'll just stay on the computer a bit longer. Okay. I'll just do that party that. Okay. Oh, and by the time you finish, just you're not even standing up straight anymore. Saying no is part of the package. Renunciation. You're going to renounce things, guys? What are the things you need to renounce tonight? What are they? You won't, honestly, you've got to do that. You've got to turn, you've got to renounce things. And that does mean taking a step you haven't felt to take before. You've been frightened of doing it. You've been uncomfortable about it. It's like going down to the beach. You've heard me say this, some of you. You go down to the beach and go into the water up to here, and it's agony because it's freezing cold in the English Channel. No matter what they say, it's not a nice place. So you go, you know, going up to my waist, and oh, you can't hack it. It's just intolerable because you're half dry, half freezing cold wet. So you come out again and try and hobble up without breaking your feet on the pebbles. And you go back in again up to about here. It's a bit better, but it's too much. You have to go out again. When does real change happen? It's when you throw yourself in, head and shoulders. You go under the water. You know when you do that, you can swim for quite a long time. You can stay in it indefinitely. Because, well, you're all in now. You're not conflicted. You've renounced something. You've turned your back. You've said, no, I'm all in now. I'm all in. And because I'm all in, there's grace for me. I can experience the fuel of the Spirit. I can know the empowerment of the Spirit changing me. He turns up. I tell you, I just know this. That when I was a teenager, I'd have seasons in life where I'd try to become a Christian young person. I'd try and be a bit more Christian. I'd go back to school, and my way of testing it was by certain things I'd try to stop doing, certain misbehaviors I would try and correct. There was no expectation of God's power in my life. It's just me being a legalist, being religious. No difference whatsoever. But when I threw my heart and soul into loving Jesus and the grace of God started working in my life, things did begin to change, surprisingly. I found, gosh, I didn't used to be like this, but I'm new now by the grace of God. Renounce and receive the gospel of grace in your life, the empowerment of grace. Some of you guys, it's a case of just turning your back, making the decision. You see, they say that you know those lion tamers, the stools they used to, the chairs they used to put at the lions' faces, and they'd have a whip and a chair. Why do they put a chair in the lion's face? What's so good about the chair? Why is that helping anybody? Well, they say it's because the chair legs would confuse the lion, because there were several points of focus coming at it. The three or four different points of focus would just bewilder the lion. It didn't know where to look. Just focusing on too many things at once, just overdoing it, just seeing too many things at once and paralyzed by the options. Some of you guys, you need to decide which option. Just that's it. I'll cancel all these other things out of my life. I'm going to press right through, be a man of God. Take decisions, push through, press through. Stop waiting for life to happen to you. You're called to self-control. You're called to serving God. You're called to making the calls, making decisions. I remember when I was looking to get serious in my relationship with Kate, we'd been going out a while, and I was excited about her, and the elders of the church I was in took me aside and said, Joel, when are you going to marry Kate? As elders do. And I said to them, well, she hasn't said anything. And they had to say to me, so you're asking for her to propose to you, is that it? And I had to realize that's exactly what I'd been doing. I'd just been waiting for God to just deliver everything, just flop, it just, there. Life just happens to me. So I had to start aggressive. I had to go and ask her to marry me. That was scary. We never talked about marriage before. I put the subject on the table and we got married. What subject do you need to start putting on the table? What steps do you need to make, gentlemen? What things do you need to say? Right, that's that. Enough of that now. Putting that aside. Renouncing it. It's ungodly. I used to tolerate it. It was one of the chair legs. No, not anymore. It's all about Jesus now. And he gives you zeal. Zealous for good works.